the House comes to oral questions. The first question is in the name of Brooke Van Velden.
My question is to the Minister of Health and reads as follows. What expectations does the Minister have of the Ministry of Health for meeting its obligations under the End of Life Choice Act, which comes into force in 11 months?
The Honourable Andrew Little.
Mr Speaker, New Zealanders voted for the End of Life Choice Act at the referendum, and we are committed to honouring and implementing that decision. I have high expectations that the Ministry of Health will meet its obligations to implement the End of Life Choice Act within the 11-month timeframe. The Ministry has 10 work streams underway to implement what is required in the Act.
Is the Minister confident that the Ministry of Health will meet all of its obligations by the 6th of November 2021? And can he give assurance to those suffering from a terminal illness hoping to access end-of-life choice that they would not needlessly suffer for one day more due to set-up delays?
Mr Speaker, the Ministry, indeed the Government, has an obligation to ensure, in accordance with the End-of-Life Choice Act, that it is implemented from, I think, the 7th of November 2021. All administrative matters, regulations, committees, review bodies and registrars have to be appointed and in place and systems functioning by that date, and they will be.
Will he be setting high expectations for the Director General of Health that all doctors, nurse practitioners, pharmacists and psychiatrists will be highly aware of the ability to join the support and consultation group so that people in remote areas will have access to end-of-life choice?
Mr Speaker, all of those matters will have to be in place in order for the Act to be operative. It's an obligation under the Act, in light of the referendum result, for that Act to enter into force and therefore to be operative from the 7th of November 2021. All of those matters that the member has referred to will be attended to and will be in place in time for the Act to enter into force.
Does he intend to publish a timetable for the setup of the Skins Group, Registrar's Office and Review Committee so that those in the medical profession and other concerned groups know what is happening and when?
Mr Speaker, the Ministry is aware of its obligations to have those matters all in place, but I'm happy to ensure that in very short order a timetable is produced laying out the work, including the consultation and stakeholder engagement process, so that all those matters are ready and as soon as the legislation comes into effect. I've already indicated to that member that I'm very keen for her to be in her party as the sponsors of the legislation to be actively involved and engaged in those processes, and I will make sure that that happens.
Will the Minister commit to a fully public process seeking nominations for the committee that will review cases where people use the End of Life Choice Act?
Mr Speaker, all of these statutory appointments required under the legislation will go through the usual appointment process that typically involves advertising for expressions of interest. There's then a standard recruitment phase, interviewing shortlisted candidates, and then it goes through the Cabinet Honours and Appointments Committee or Subcommittee. And all of that will be done, as I've indicated, in time for the legislation to take effect.
Will he set the expectation for the Ministry of Health to work with the Medical Council and colleges to develop clinical guidelines for practitioners?
Mr Speaker, I've, in my engagements with the Ministry so far, they've indicated they've established the work streams. They understand the stakeholder engagement requirements on them to make those effective. And I'm confident that there will be good quality engagement with the New Zealand Medical Association and the various professional colleges.
Question number two, Helen White.
My question's for the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr Speaker, today Treasury have released the Crown accounts for the 4 months to October. The Obergale deficit for the year to October 2020 was $3.8 billion, but this is against a forecast deficit of nearly $9 billion at the recent pre-election fiscal update. Core Crown expenses were 4.3% lower than expected, while Core Crown revenue was 10% higher than forecast at pre-food. It's interesting to note, Mr. Speaker, that revenue was higher than forecast from wages, company taxation and GST, illustrating the stronger employment, GDP and consumer confidence data we have seen in recent months. Mr. Speaker, these figures show the continued resilience of the New Zealand economy despite the global COVID-19 slowdown. They also demonstrate the continued prudent management of the government's books and careful control of government spending.
What did the Crown Accounts state about the levels of government debt?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm pleased to report that the net core Crown debt was $3.1 billion less than forecast at 31.5% of GDP at the end of October 2020. While, Mr. Speaker, this is larger than New Zealand is used to, on an internationally comparable basis, our debt is lower than Canada, Ireland, Japan, the United Kingdom, the United States, Australia and others.
What did the Crown Accounts state about debt servicing costs?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm pleased to inform the House that for the year to October 2020, total Crown finance costs were 10% lower than forecast at pre-food. So debt servicing costs remain low and they are forecast to remain so.
Oh, that's great. Question number three, Dr. Shane Retty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister for Child Poverty Reduction. Since the passing of the Child Poverty Reduction Act 2018, which, if any, of the economising behaviours measured in the DEP 17 material hardship questions have become more common, and if any, which of these has increased the most?
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
On behalf of the Minister, we do not have this data available for only households with children prior to the 2018-19 figures, which were released in February 2020. I can advise that for all families, including those without children, there have been small increases in the following economising behaviours in the survey, which covers the period from mid-2017 to mid-2019. Cutting back on fresh fruit and vegetables, feeling cold to save on heating costs, repairing or replacing broken or damaged appliances, and visits to the doctors. The most significant of these is postponing visits to the doctor, which is why we have already made changes to improve access to GPs by reducing the cost for up to 540,000 community services card holders and making visits free for 56,000 13-year-olds. I can also advise that there were fewer families who bought less or cheaper meat, postponed visits to the dentist and went without local trips. Mr. Speaker, I would say that it is important that in looking at these individual items that the DEP 17 index is not the way that experts would say is an effective way to monitor and understand the levels of material hardship.
Supplementary. Which of the government's measures of material hardship are most affected by rising house prices?
Well, Mr. Speaker, again, I think that references the last point that I made, lifting out the individual details of the costs that are on families doesn't give a full picture. Clearly, rising house prices and rising rentals affect a range of expenses that people will undertake.
Supplementary. For every $10,000 increase in median house prices, how many children, if any, may move into a state of material hardship?
Mr. Speaker, I'm sure the member is fully aware that a question with that level of detail would need to be put down in writing to be answered.
Supplementary, is the answer to that question more people now than there were a month ago?
Quite clearly we've seen rapidly escalating house prices, but it seems to me that most of the initiatives that this government has taken to improve the lot of the lowest income New Zealanders have been opposed by the National Party. Be that the increases to the minimum wage, the support that we gave to beneficiaries at the beginning of COVID-19, a range of measures that we've undertaken the National Party have opposed.
Supplementary. How does she rate her performance in improving the state of children in material hardship to date?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, we have always acknowledged that this is a big job where there is a lot more to do. What I can be very proud of has been the Minister who put in place the Child Poverty Reduction Act so that we actually have indicators to report against, and being the Minister who's overseen the introduction of the Families Package that's lifting hundreds of thousands of New Zealanders out of poverty.
Supplementary. What does she say to recent statements by the Children's Commissioner and Treasury that hardship rates for children may increase further?
Well, Mr. Speaker, what I would say is this government is committed to doing absolutely everything that we can to reduce those.
Question number four, Angela Roberts.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Education. What support is the government giving to schools to help them reduce their carbon emissions?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, I recently announced 41 schools from the far north to Southland that will receive funding for projects to help reduce their schools' emissions and to save them money. This was the second round of the Sustainability Contestable Fund, and work will begin immediately. These initiatives will help to reduce carbon emissions and costs for schools across the country.
Supplementary. Can he give examples of the kind of project that the Sustainability Contestable Fund supports?
Well, Mr. Speaker, yes I can, but I'll only choose two. Ladbrokes School in Hallswell installed new LED lighting, new low-flow tap fittings, a heat pump system to replace an old electric hot water cylinder, and more efficient heat pumps to replace electric fan and panel heaters. Mr. Speaker, at Randwick School, Randwick School in Lower Hutt, there were 48 solar panels being installed, and it's estimated that's going to save the school $2,600 in the first year alone, with its savings expected to total more than $65,000 over 25 years.
Supplementary. Is this all about solar panels and boiler replacement, or are there other sorts of things happening as well?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, that's a very good question. Solar panels and boilers replacements are very popular projects, but we've seen other innovations funded, including rainwater collection, water conservation initiatives, composting and recycling initiatives. These projects also help to build business confidence by providing a pipeline of work for local suppliers and contractors like plumbers, gas fitters, electricians and builders.
Mentory, what other action has the government taken to support schools to reduce their carbon emissions?
Mr. Speaker, more good news. We've also committed $55 million through the State Sector Decarbonisation Fund to replace up to 90 coal boilers in schools with low emissions alternatives like wood chip boilers.
Supplementary. The Honourable Stuart Nash.
To the Minister, and if at all possible, Minister, will these new schools or school refurbs be built out of wood?
Mr. Speaker, I thank the Minister of Forestry for the question, Mr. Speaker. And in fact, I can report that I recently visited Waimea College, who have built 9 new classrooms with wood-only technology, removing a lot of concrete and a lot of steel from the construction process.
The Honourable Damien O'Connor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Will the Minister consider instructing officials to look at wool as a suitable flooring material and insulation material for all those new construction projects?
Mr. Speaker, I can advise the Minister that is, of course, one of the things that we will continue to consider.
I think we'll refer to those members as wooden and woolly, but
point of order. Mr. Speaker, you've just taken 3 supplementaries from us.
Yes.
Just wonder why that was.
Because 3 members interjected when a member was asking a question.
Yeah, well, just ask us some consistency, because when the Honourable Damien O'Connor was asking his supplementary, then there was quite a degree of noise and interjections from the Labor members. It's a fairly jovial question. Members were enjoying the spirit of near Christmas on a Thursday afternoon,
yep,
on a question that people were enjoying. So.
Well, I think there's a significant difference between Mr. O'Connor will stand, withdraw and apologise.
I withdraw and apologise.
I think members are aware of the difference between a slight murmur of humour and disparaging loud noises, as at least 3 members made while Ms. Roberts was asking her supplementary question. Question number 5, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
My question is to the Minister of Transport. Does he agree with all the findings on the Auckland Light Rail City Centre to Mangere project reached by the Controller and Auditor-General, as set out in his letter to the CEO of the Ministry of Transport, dated 26 November? If not, what findings does he not agree with?
The Honourable Michael Wood.
Mr. Speaker, I respect the role and the function of the Auditor-General, and while his report does not provide specific findings, I note the views that he expresses and his intention to, quote, help inform any future procurement process for the provision of light rail in Auckland or other similarly complex infrastructure projects. In light of that, I intend to take his views fully into account as the project moves forward.
Was the government's request to pause market engagement on light rail so the NZ Infra proposal could be examined more closely made against the advice of officials?
The report notes that there was differing advice on this matter.
Oh, is it? Okay. Were the mandatory procurement rules that set out the standards of good practice for government procurement breached by the decision to follow a twin-track process?
The letter from the Auditor-General notes that this was a highly complex process and also notes that the rules need to be interpreted in a way that is sufficiently flexible to respond to innovative proposals.
No, that's a guideline. To the Minister, does he agree with the Auditor-General that a process that was not in compliance with the government's own rules, quote, put New Zealand's reputation at risk domestically and internationally, end quote?
I agree with the views expressed by the Auditor-General that these considerations did open up areas of risk, but given the significant market engagement that the government has with its transport program, I don't see that as a risk that has been borne out.
Well, has that market engagement failed to the point that the government will need to restart the procurement process as a consequence of those issues, and does this mean we've wasted 3 years?
The government ended the twin-track process in July 2020, and because of that, we'll be restarting any procurement process once further decisions have been made on this important project.
Question number six, the Honourable Eugenie Sage.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Oceans and Fisheries. Does he plan any reform of fisheries management? If so, what are his priorities for the reform?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable David Parker.
This government will continue to improve the environmental and economic sustainability of our fisheries sector, where a range of environmental, recreational, tangata whenua and commercial interests can be pursued through an abundant fishery and a sustainable environment. We will build on the sustainability measures we've already introduced and continue to roll out cameras on boats, implement the Hectors and Maui Dolphin Threat Management Plan, continue working on sea change project within the Hauraki Gulf and the Rangitahua Kermadec Reserve proposal. We'll work with industry to help modernise fishing practices towards an ecosystem-based management approach and rebuild fish stocks that have been overfished. We will update marine protected areas legislation to ensure it's fit for purpose, focusing on the future framework we need to protect our precious spaces and marine biodiversity.
Supplementary. Following his recent reported comment that, and I quote, there are some legitimate concerns about the adverse environmental effects of bottom trawling, end quote, what action, if any, is he considering to address those concerns to protect seamounts, decades-old corals, from bottom trawling?
Mr. Speaker, I recently accepted a petition on bottom trawling from the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition here at Parliament. Although I look forward to the Select Committee consideration of that petition. We do need to do better in respect of bottom trawling. Sustainability is an ongoing journey. New Zealand's made good progress, but there is and will always be more to do.
Supplementary. What action, if any, is he considering to restrict or phase out other environmentally damaging fishing methods, such as set netting and dredging?
Well, in respect of set netting, there's already been a major change in respect of the extension of the areas that are prohibited for use of nets as a consequence of the threat management plan that I've already referred to for the Maui's dolphin and also Hector's dolphins. I haven't got anything else to bring to the attention of the House today.
Is he confident that the former National Government's 2016 review of the quota management system is an adequate and appropriate basis for reform of fisheries management, or does he intend to initiate a more comprehensive review?
We're not proposing to review whether the QMS should exist. We see its continuance as important. We agree that some updates around the edges need to be made. The Prime Minister of Fisheries started on some of that work and I will continue it.
Does the Minister believe that the current suite of tools in the quota management system, such as annual catch entitlements, are adequate to ensure sustainable and abundant fisheries? And if so, why?
Some of the rules in the QMS encourage the wrong result, which is one of the reasons why rules are being changed to remove the incentive, for example, which the current system encourages discards.
Does he agree with legacy spokesperson Sam Walford that, and I quote, a major flaw with the quota management system is that 56% of targeted fish stocks have never been scientifically assessed, so we have no idea if they are overfished, end quote, and if not, why not?
I'm aware that of that statistics. I'm also aware that if you use a different denominator, namely the take these matters as a proportion of the biomass that is caught, you get a different answer. I'm looking forward to the imminent report from the Chief Science Advisor on her views as to how we reconcile these things.
Question number 7, the Honourable Louise Upston.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and Employment and asks, is she confident the Government's policies and actions to address youth unemployment are fit for purpose?
The Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
Mr. Speaker, yes. The Government has laid out our approach to youth unemployment through our employment strategy and the Youth Employment Action Plan. We reiterated this commitment during the election and in the speech from the throne last week. Our plan includes continuing successful programs like Mana and Mahi, He Potama Rangatahi, free apprenticeships and training, rolling out Tupu Aotearoa, and new investment into things like expanding flexi wage and the training incentive allowance, to name a few. We are proud of our record of investing in young people, and while there is more to do, we know this investment is already making a difference for many.
Supplementary. How many 18 to 24-year-olds were on the JobSeeker benefit at the end of October this year? And how does this compare to the number of 18 to 24-year-olds on JobSeeker benefit at the end of October 2019?
Mr. Speaker, I will say that globally, our countries are experiencing an issue with employment or higher levels of unemployment, and unfortunately the reality is for many countries that young people bear the brunt of recessions like we are faced with now. So the numbers of under 24-year-olds on benefit in October 2020 was 68,745, and that compares to 49,155 in October 2019.
What is the maximum number of people the Government's youth employment schemes, He Potama Rangatahi and Mana and Mahi, can actually support into work with the 68,000 18 to 24-year-olds on benefit at the end of October?
Mr. Speaker, it's important to mention that there's no one or even two program that has been developed to address unemployment or employment for young people. Mana and Mahi is one, He Potama Rangatahi is another, but as I said, there is more happening, including the apprenticeship boost. If I only refer to Mana and Mahi, 1,622 young people have enrolled or completed Mana and Mahi to date. The achievement has been good, the retention has been good. The vast majority have either completed, are still on the program, or have exited onto employment or training elsewhere.
Will the Minister set a specific target to reduce the number of 18 to 24-year-olds on benefit with the Government's own employment strategy saying, quote, they are at a far greater risk of poorer outcomes later in life, including lower wages, lower employment levels...
Order. The Member's completed a question. The quote is not necessary. Carmel Cipollone.
Mr. Speaker, as we saw from the last national government, simply putting targets in place doesn't necessarily address the issues that young people face in this country or unemployment in general. I think if we reflect back to the time following...
Order. Member resume his seat. there was a very clear question asked, and the minister has not yet started to address it. She will address the question that was asked rather than other matters which she would prefer to do.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker. Perhaps just saying that as the member went on, I potentially lost track of the question. Okay. So perhaps member could repeat her question.
I will tell the member, because I was listening, and it was a question about whether the minister will set targets.
Mr. Speaker, simply setting targets does not necessarily achieve the results that we as a country need to be achieved. So, Mr. Speaker, what we are doing is using an evidence approach to supporting young people into employment, upskilling and training. Mr. Speaker, we want to support as many young people as we possibly can to realise their potential. And, Mr. Speaker, this government's investment in upskilling and training, including apprenticeships, clearly indicates that we are committed to that.
Is the minister satisfied with 69,000 young people under the age of 25 on benefit, that programs like Mana and Mahi are only serving 1,600?
Mr. Speaker, if Mana and Mahi was the only program, then yes, I would be concerned. But we have a vast array of programs that have been put in place to be able to support young people into employment, upskilling and training. Mr. Speaker, we don't want to see any New Zealand young person have potential wasted. And so, Mr. Speaker, we are doing our very best to actually support all young people in New Zealand.
We'll have one person answering the question, not the person who asked the question trying to answer it from her bench.
To realise their potential.
Question number 8, Tangi Utakere.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for the Environment and asks, what actions is the government taking to reform the resource management system?
Mr. Speaker.
Honourable David Parker.
Improving our planning system is a priority for the Labor government. The current system takes too long, costs too much and has not adequately protected the environment. The government will ensure that New Zealand's resource management system is fit for the future by repealing and replacing the Resource Management Act. The Randerson Review provides a sound platform for the government to advance this work. In the first 6 months of 2021, the government intends to release an exposure draft of key elements of the first bill, the Natural and Environments Act.
Plumetri, what legislation did the Randerson Review recommend to replace the RMA?
The panel recommended the RMA be replaced with three pieces of legislation. Firstly, the Natural and Built Environments Act that would provide the framework for both built environments and regulation of the natural environment. Secondly, the Strategic Planning Act that would overlay the NBA. And thirdly, a Managed Retreat and Climate Change Adaptation Act that would seek to prepare us better for climate change.
Supplementary, how will the Natural and Built Environments Act and Strategic Planning Act differ from the existing RMA?
The Natural and Built Environments Act will better protect environmental outcomes and limits via a mandatory set of national direction. At the same time, there will be less emphasis on subjective amenity values to assist development in built areas. A single NBA plan for each region will reduce the number of plans from over 100 to about 14. The Strategic Planning Act will sit above the NBA, and under it there will be long-term regional spatial strategies developed to help integrate decisions under the NBA, the Land Transport Management Act, the Local Government Act and the Climate Change Response Act.
Supplementary, how will the exposure draft be progressed?
To advance the NBA, I intend to request a select committee to commence a select committee inquiry on an exposure draft, with refinements being made and further material added prior to the bill being formally introduced to the House. This will allow all parties in this House an opportunity to contribute to the policy process to ensure that the replacement for the RMA endures through subsequent governments.
The Honourable Scott Simpson.
To the Minister, does he agree with the Minister of Economic and Regional Development, who recently said on News Talk ZB of the Government's work on the RMA that, quote, by the end of next year, it'll be done and dusted?
We'll be well underway by then.
We have faith. He's a great minister.
Question number 9, Dr. James McDowell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Immigration and reads as follows. Will further border exemptions be provided for sharing workers? If not, why not?
The Honourable Chris Farfoy.
Mr. Speaker, the Government has been very clear that its priority is to protect New Zealanders from COVID-19 and support the economic recovery. This is why we do have stringent quarantine health systems at the border, and we control the number of people moving across the border. So on that note, the Government has enabled 60 sharers to come to New Zealand to assist with the peak of the sharing season. This is a decision welcomed by the Federated Farmers Meat and Wool Chair, William Beetham, who has said, quote, we really appreciate how hard it has been for the government to manage this issue and keep New Zealand safe, and we really appreciate the fact that they understand the importance of animal welfare and have provided these exemptions. I thank Mr. Beetham for that. Mr. Speaker, we will continue to engage with the industry around labour demands and exceptions in the future.
Supplementary. Is he confident that the border exemptions provided for 60 shearers will be sufficient for the shearing season, given reports that the New Zealand Shearing Contractors Association initially applied for 200?
Mr. Speaker, I'm very glad the member asked that specific question, because Damien O'Connor has been working very closely with the New Zealand Shearers Contracting Association to make sure that we have what we believe is the minimum viable number to make sure that we can get through the issues with the border at the moment. I will remind the member the border is closed, so we can't bring in as many shearers as we have. And I would also note that for some years the New Zealand Shearers Contracting Association has pointed out that there hasn't been any training of the local workers for shearing. And I'd like to thank this side of the House for investing $1.8 million into a training pilot program to make sure we can get local workers into that workforce and not relying on people from coming from overseas.
Supplementary. Yep. Will the Minister take responsibility for any animal welfare issues that arise from unshorn sheep that become fly-blown due to the lack of shearing in this season?
Mr. Speaker, I'm confident that because we work closely with the New Zealand Shearers Contracting Association and we've had praise from the likes of the head of Meat and Wool for Federated Farmers, that we have the local workforce and the immigrant workforce to make sure that we can get through the season without any issues.
Kieran McAnulty.
In light of the Minister's support for the shearing industry, will he confirm to the House's attendance at next year's Golden Shears?
Order, order. Member will resume his seat. Supplementary, Kieran McAnulty.
Thank you very much. To the Minister, what border exemptions has the Government announced to support the primary sector?
Mr. Speaker, the Government recognises the important role of the primary sector in driving our economic recovery. And so far, we have issued border exemptions for 30 veterinarians, 570 deep fishing crew, 210 agricultural mobile plant operators, 2,000 REC workers to support the horticulture and wine growing, and as I said in my primary answer, 60 experienced sheep shearers who we hope to see at the Golden Shears.
Yeah. And I'll be going for the shears.
Question number 10, Arena Williams.
Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Māori Development. What steps has the Government taken to support the Māori economy through Government procurement targets?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Willie Jackson.
Mr. Speaker, today alongside my colleague Stuart Nash, the Minister for Economic and Regional Development, I announced this Government's decision to increase supplier diversity by setting a new procurement target of 5% for Māori businesses and enterprise. The new 5% target for public service contracts for Māori businesses is an important step towards a more inclusive and prosperous society, and we are honouring our manifesto commitment to better support whānau and Māori enterprise.
Why is the Government introducing procurement targets for Māori?
Mr. Speaker, we want to ensure that the Government procure goods and services from more diverse suppliers and small to medium businesses, with the benefits flowing back into communities. Small and medium businesses face significant challenges as a result of COVID-19, and that is exactly why targeting Māori businesses and jobs is a big priority for this new government.
When will the policy be implemented?
Mr. Speaker, we don't need to wait. The policy supports buyers to be more intentional with their spend within the existing quality assurance parameters. It's anticipated government agencies will take the policy into account when they go to market for each contract. The initial target of 5% will be reviewed at the end of next year, and I have a real expectation that the data collected will support increasing the Māori social procurement target further.
What support will be available to Māori businesses and enterprise to take advantage of the new procurement target?
Mr. Speaker, TPK Te Puni Kōkiri has contracted Amultai, formerly known as He Waka Eke Noa, to offer intermediary services that include making connections between Māori businesses and buyers, verifying that businesses are Māori businesses, practical business support and training for SMEs. Intermediaries have an important role in matching buyers with suppliers and linking businesses to capability support.
Sorry, the member wants a supplementary.
Yes.
Well, unfortunately, the member's office sent me an email saying that all the Māori Party supplementaries... the email that I saw said that all the Māori Party supplementaries were going to the ACT Party. If I can have an assurance that that is not the case, then I will give the member a supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, in the email I saw, the ACT Party was offered 3 out of 4 supplementary questions from the Māori Party.
Okay, it'll be quite good if those ones are sent to me as well, because the one that I got said 4. Rawari.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Waititi.
The Māori Party campaigned on a 25% procurement. This government is saying 5%.
Order, order. The member will resume his seat. The member starting right off with a supplementary for which the minister has no responsibility. He has no responsibility for the Māori Party policy. And you can't ask him about that. So just get a narrow question around what the minister is responsible for.
Is he aware the Māori population is 16%? Where did he get his 5% from?
Mr. Speaker, the 5% target is an aspirational target. And I know it's hard for the opposition to understand that word, but it's a target based on the volume of contract, not the value. And it is a really good start, Mr. Speaker, because the National Party refused to acknowledge Indigenous procurement. And I say to the member to tautoko what we're doing and support this percentage. It's a good start for our party, and we're hoping to increase it over the next 12 months.
Before the member does, I'm going to warn Chris Bishop. This is now the third time I've warned him for inappropriate interjections today. The Honourable Nanaia Mahuta.
Supplementary to the Minister. Can the Minister confirm that in terms of the number of Māori businesses able to procure across a range of government contracts, it is very difficult to assess whether or not they are able to fully procure 5%, and we've got to start somewhere.
Mr. Speaker, I can confirm that to the minister.
All right. There's been okay. The member's finished his answer.
Oh yes, we have. Mr. Speaker, can the minister confirm whether or not he has received any correspondence from the National Party as to whether or not they would support a 16% target for Māori procurement?
Mr. Speaker, not in the last 50 years have we received anything from the National Party to support any Indigenous procurement. Shame on the National Party, sir.
Question number 11. Before I ask the member to ask this question, I'll warn the House that the Minister's office has indicated to me that this answer might be slightly longer than normal. Simeon Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Police. What are her plans, if any, to reduce gun violence in New Zealand from its highest levels in nearly a decade?
Honourable Porter Williams.
Mr Speaker, first of all, let me acknowledge the officers involved in the recent Northland shooting. I'm sure every member of this House would join me in commending their professionalism and bravery, along with the family of Constable Matthew Hunt, who I had the privilege of meeting this week. Mr Speaker, the Government is committed to continuing the biggest reforms of our firearms legislation in New Zealand's history. Already we have banned military-style semi-automatic weapons, magazines and parts, taken 62,000 prohibited firearms out of circulation and passed the Arms Legislation Bill, which National voted against. Mr Speaker, there is a great deal more to do and I intend to make further announcements in the new year.
Supplementary. What specific actions will she be taking in response to the four incidents in the last 3 months of shootings against police officers in Northland, including the shooting of a police dog this week?
Mr Speaker, can I say, Mr Speaker, that any incident with the use of weapons where the use of weapons is involved is distressing for the police and the community, and police are frontline workers who go above and beyond to keep our community safe. We need to support our officers so we can continue to support our communities. But Mr Speaker, I'm sick of National's virtue signalling on law and order. Under them, police numbers fell. Under National, they are up. 2,200 new constables, 1,280 new FTEs, 700 alone focused on organised crime. This government delivers for police, unlike the other side who just talked.
The member has answered the question.
Order.
Point of order, Mr Speaker. That was a very direct, succinct, non-political question, and it was not addressed by the Minister at all. It was about specific actions the Minister has taken.
Mr Speaker, can I answer by saying that we have increased...
Speaking to the point of order,
Mr Speaker, I did answer that in saying that we have increased police numbers and targeting organised crime by 700. Now, they work specifically with gang violence.
And I think if there hadn't been so much noise from the members' colleagues, he would have heard that, even if the Honourable Stuart Nash wanted it repeated. Right. One more here.
Tree. Will she make it a priority to address increasing firearm violence in counties Manukau? And is she concerned about comments from Police Association President Chris Cahill, quote, frontline officers in South Auckland feel compelled to wear anti-ballistic plate armour because they encounter firearms on a daily basis, end quote?
Mr Speaker, can I say that I support the work of our frontline police? They go out to support us every single day to keep us and our community safe. But Mr Speaker, can I just remind that member that National voted against tougher penalties on gun crime. National voted against new powers to deal with returning terrorists, and National voted against harsher penalties for those who push synthetic drugs.
What's wrong? Ms. Tom McKee.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. How will the government's policy of introducing a firearms register reduce firearm violence?
Mr Speaker, reforms to date have been about responding to the need to prohibit dangerous firearms and strengthen and improve the existing legislative and regulatory regime. A key goal of the reforms already agreed by this House is to reduce the likelihood of lawful firearms getting into the hands of people who will use them for harm rather than for legitimate purpose.
Supplementary. What does she say to Diane Hunt, mother of slain Constable Matthew Hunt, and the 39,000 people who signed a petition to protect police officers and who said, quote, they all deserve to come home and there needs to be more deterrence to stop people from thinking they can shoot them as they see fit, unquote?
Mr Speaker, I had the privilege and honour of meeting with Mrs Hunt and her family, And I have to say to her that I agree that this country needs to support and honour and acknowledge the work of our frontline police staff. I have full confidence that our select committee process will be robust and appropriate, and I look forward to the recommendations from her petition.
Will she support my member's bill, the Arms Firearms Prohibition Orders Amendment Bill, to take guns out of the hands of these violent criminals, and if not, why not?
Mr. Speaker, unfortunately, National's bill is fundamentally flawed. It would only have targeted gang members with convictions. What about other dangerous, high-risk people who are not gang members? It left significant gaps and will not effectively deliver the public safety objectives that we seek.
That's what you call it. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does the minister expect criminals committing gun violence to actually register their firearms?
Mr. Speaker, the firearms register is targeted at those who would register their firearms so that we can actually identify how many firearms
Order.
The member resume his seat. I'm sick of this not being able to hear a member because people are shouting her down. I've had enough of it. This reply, the balance of this reply, will be heard in silence.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The purpose of the register is to register firearms, and we know that those legitimate firearms users will do so. This will allow us to track firearms should they be stolen, so that we know the whole purpose of this for the member is to know how many firearms we have in the community. And we know that legitimate firearms owners will do that, and we will be able to track firearms that are then stolen from them.
Question number 12.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker, if I may.
Point of order, Nicole McKee.
My question to the Minister was asking whether or not she expected the criminals to register her firearms, and their firearms, my apologies, but the response I got was that the law-abiding are expected to register them. So
speaking
I'd like to know
point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Speaking to the point of order, the Honourable
That Parliament. Is far away from the primary question, which asks about
order,
my plans
order,
to reduce.
Order.
Well, hang on, I haven't brought on the point of order yet,
sorry.
So we're trying to get out. And I think the member had a valid point of order, and that was it was a very specific question about whether or not the minister expected criminals to register their firearms. She answered, you know, people can have a debate about the quality of the answer, another question, and she will now answer the original, the supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I don't expect criminals to do anything lawful. My expectation is that lawful gun owners will abide by the law and the register. The point of the register is to understand how many firearms there are in the community. Unfortunately, if we had been able to have a
order,
register...
Order, the member, I think in the first sentence, actually answered the question. Question number 12, Joe Luxon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Conservation, what recent announcements has she made about the Milford track?
The Honourable Kiritapu Allen.
I thank the member for that fantastic question. Mr. Speaker, on 30th of November, I announced the full reopening of the iconic Milford track. Hikers booked on the popular Great Walk are now able to complete the walk end to end for the first time since it was closed due to extensive flood damage in early February. Mr. Speaker, the reopening is a milestone in the flood recovery work taking place in the Fiordland and Mount Aspiring National Park areas, and is a testament to the hard work achieved by both Te Papa Atawhaim, the Department of Conservation, and the many, many contractors involved in the rebuild work.
Fantastic.
How did funding allocated in Budget 2020 contribute to the reopening of the Milford track?
Mr. Speaker, $13.7 million was included in Budget 2020 for repairing vital conservation and visitor infrastructure destroyed in the February flood. Mr. Speaker, I want to take a moment to commend and acknowledge my good friend and colleague, the Honourable Eugenie Sage, for her work in securing that funding. Completing repairs and getting the Milford track back up and running has been a priority for Te Papa Atawhai, and
order,
it is pleasing...
Order, that's enough.
How will the reopening of the Milford track contribute to the economic recovery from COVID, particularly for the Te Anau community?
Mr Speaker, the reopening of the track is absolutely fundamental and critical for the economic recovery of the people of Te Anau. This community relies heavily on tourism and has had an extremely difficult year due to the downturn of economic activity as a consequence of COVID-19. So this track draws thousands of visitors to the region every year, and the reopening sends a strong signal to the area that the area is open for business and will be welcoming visitors throughout the summer season.
Oh, surely not.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. What progress has been made on fully reopening the Rootboon track?
Another fantastic question from the member.
Order.
Mr Speaker.
No, member will resume his seat. That concludes oral questions.